the tape for the podcast.
Tonight's subject is the internet. Bringing the Dharma to the way we interact with the internet and discussing about how the it can be both our online activities, our connected activities can be both useful and detrimental, skillful and unskillful. As the Buddha called it, kusala and akusala. So, to start with, the basic outline is I'm going to talk about why it's so compelling. Go over some of the benefits and the drawbacks, and then ways we can bring mindfulness to our interactions online. So very briefly, the first part, why it's so compelling. When we look at a screen, it doesn't matter whether it's a laptop, a large monitor, the small interface on a smartphone, a video console, television set, any monitor or screen is not a solid object. It's actually light being projected and moving across an area, refreshing at somewhere between 30 and 50 times per second. When you look at a piece of paper that's stationary and solid, it doesn't require the use of that many of the visual regions of the brain to interpret. But when we look at a screen and we're trying to interpret the words, the images, the events, the movement on the screen, it actually requires a lot of visual processing in an area of the brain called the occipital lobe. Now, this processing, following a screen, interpreting what a screen is showing you, on its own, triggers the release of dopamine and the brain's reward system. When you are looking at a screen, you are actively engaging the survival mechanism in the brain that rewards you for following new information. This does not happen when you look at a sunset or a single piece of paper. The most boring page on the internet, think the home page of the New York Times leaps to mind for some reason, triggers more dopamine than virtually the vast majority of the images you will see in a printed magazine, because it requires the use of so much of the occipital lobe simply to interpret. And to interpret it, to keep you understanding it, to keep you in the game of deciphering a screen, your brain is actually tricking itself into believing that everything it sees on a TV or a monitor is important for your survival. I'm going to talk about why this is not such a good idea in a moment, but beyond that, the internet also has push feeds. Facebook news feeds, emails with content coming at you. It's constantly moving, which again, even more so than just interpreting the information, this constant flow of data also requires the release of dopamine to follow and maintain our awareness on. And then on top of it, it's actually curated directly to your interests. If you go to an embarrassing page, maybe an embarrassing shot, you go there and you're like, ooh, this stuff is not for me, they will more than likely cookie you, and then you go on an entirely different page, and there it is again, directed at you, that swim trunks or whatever it is you were looking for that you talked yourself out of, it's there again and again and again, targeted to you. The content on Facebook is your friends. The emails coming at you are directed at you. So this triggers our self-interest. Our ego is manipulated into thinking that all of the stuff that happens online in some way affects our reputation or is good or bad for us, something that we should stay hooked into. So, in a myriad of different ways, it's an experience that manipulates us into staying with it. Before I go into all the drawbacks, there are many, many benefits. Let's face it, from the top line, it's not going to go anywhere. And the vast majority of us are going to use the internet and our ability to connect via text and all the other ways that we can connect electronically. We're going to continue using it. It does allow for a democratization of information. Small artists can get a lot more attention. Political organizations that would have a hard time reaching any membership can use it. It allows for small businesses to find support. It allows for people who are separated by vast distances and who cannot sync themselves always with telephone communication, allows people to connect in that way. It does, in and of itself, Wikipedia alone makes me wish I was born at least 20 years later than I was. Kids, you won't believe this, but there was a time when if you had to write a paper, you'd have to go to a library where they had something called the Dewey Decimal System, which was incomprehensible. And even after employing the help of bored librarians, the book you would look for would not be there. Or the pages that you wanted in the book would be torn out by somebody who didn't want anybody else to have access to those few pages. When I write these talks, I can come up with an idea and willy-nilly, within a half hour, have more information on the subject than I know what to do with. It's all there at the tip of my finger. So there's many, many benefits. And nothing in tonight's talk is going to be about completely cutting away the use of the internet. The Buddha did not teach complete he didn't encourage us to steep ourselves in sensual pleasures, nor the exact opposite, to unnecessarily completely abandon that which has uses. He taught a third path, and we're going to be talking about that. But let's talk about first some of the drawbacks of it. The first is that because it releases and employs the use of so much dopamine, there's already a direct link between use of monitors and the internet and attention deficit disorder. This is because if we use up the dopamine, and we only have so much of it, like anything else, if we use it up during the time we're on the internet, the interactions that are not on screen will not be interesting. We will have a problem following and focusing on them. This is noticeable in up to 30 to 40% of the population. I mean, that's a huge amount. If that's not scary enough, a recent study of Chinese students where they broke up the students into one group that volunteered to not use the internet for 2 months and a group that would use it for 6 days a week to play online video games and do their papers. After the 2 months was over, they did fMRI scans for a second time on the students, and they discovered that gray matter in the frontal lobe was diminishing. It ate away the frontal lobe. I don't know how to make that scarier. If you say after that, yeah, but get, cut to the chase. What's the bottom line? Why should I care about this? I don't know what to say. The stuff that makes you think was going away. What else do you need to know? What? Why was it? Well, actually, because what happens is while we're online, we are hardwiring and distributing gray matter via blood supply to the occipital lobe, the part of the brain that interprets data on screen. That's what you need to watch a screen, not the frontal lobe high-order processing that allows you to weigh information, allows you to make smart decisions. When we're on screen, the vast bulk of the blood flow and all of the attention and awareness of the cingulate is going to the back of the brain, to the occipital lobe, for the higher order processing that allows us to decipher something that's being shown to us. Now, let's look at some subtle psychological implications. When, this is another journey back in time, back in the 1980s or 1970s, when I would rip my black jeans and need to get a new pair, I would organize a trip with my friends down to Trash and Vaudeville, or across. I actually didn't live that far, but to Trash and Vaudeville or to Canal Street Jeans. You'd go there, you'd shop with the $15 you had if you were lucky, looking for a pair of $10 jeans. And it would take a while, and you'd go through a whole bunch of different things, and none of them would be in your size. Eventually, you'd find one or two pairs, and you'd weigh, oh my goodness, can I afford to buy this? And you'd give it to the bored, angry-looking clerk who invariably worked at Trash and Vaudeville and ask them to hold it for you while you went a few blocks down to have a pita and a veggie burger on pita with carrot and ginger sauce at a place called Dojo's, because that was the only place that you could afford. I'm putting it on the second person because none of this applies to me. but anyway, the whole process took time and it took space. There was a temporal dimension to shopping, a spatial dimension. You went somewhere, it took time, there was a pause, you could determine. Now let's cut to 30 years later, where the simplest impulse, oh, I'm having a bad day, somebody said something I don't like. I saw a pair of, what accent am I doing? I went into something and it's just very weird. Southern something. Anyway, I'm feeling uncomfortable. I know, retail therapy. I'll just go on this site. I'll enter my waist size, my favorite color. Bang! There are 700 things pushed at me on sale. So it's tricking my ventral media and the frontal gyrus into even more interest. And all I have to do is click a button. As I was saying yesterday, it's the same thing as if you went to a party where everybody was naked and laddered up for sex. And all you had to do was say, yes. Think of all the bad situations you would get into.
What party was this?
Now, we talked about that. All right, so you get the idea. There's no pause between the physical interest and the actual craving and acting. We've removed the pause entirely, and the Buddha taught that that pause between feeling a craving or a discomfort and urge for something, which is known as vedana, and then all the thinking and the acting, which is tanha, upadana, bhava, that little pause is our opportunity to get out, to stop. But when we removed it entirely, we encourage impulse. actions. And impulse actions are not spiritually a good idea, nor are they a good idea in any adult capacity. The internet increases the likelihood of avoidant coping strategies. What does this mean? Avoidant coping strategies are simply when, rather than doing something interpersonally that's difficult and challenging, we use the feeling of anonymity or the feeling of not having to look or see or be exposed to the other person to get it done. We have an entire new generation of people who know hooking up by texting, "Hey, what's up?" And if they're not interested in you, you don't have to see the look of, "Why are you interested in me? I wouldn't sleep with you if you were the last person on earth," etc. We're hidden from it. We don't have to actually risk the interpersonal engagement. So it allows us to do things without literally learning how to be with the discomfort of expanding our behavioral capacity. Everything that's new that you do requires discomfort. And if everything we do interpersonally we avoid by doing it via asynchronous communication, via texting, we are not learning how to work through difficult, uncomfortable conversations. If we break up via text, if we ask somebody out via text, if we say, "Hey, you pissed me off," via text, we are not teaching ourselves how to walk through the important, necessary, conflictual experiences that adult life and peaceful, happy life requires. Additionally, there's a lot of what's known as flaming and trolling. If you don't know what that is, that's the irritating person on every single page of the internet that writes something racist, misogynist, xenophobic, or just plain hurtful to rile up other people. And it doesn't matter what you do, how skillful you try to be, there will always be somebody there who will do that. And these are people who have never, ever, ever in their lives learned to walk up to somebody and have a disagreement. And so, because they've avoided it, they choose the complete hiding of the anonymity of comment. And what this creates is the illusion that we're doing something about unfairness in life by, through hiding, putting in comments. That doesn't achieve anything. All activism, all movements that give birth to rights for people and anything of value in the world requires courage. Nothing ever gets done through hiding. So it also encourages what I would call misrepresentation. The internet, we're so used to selling things that we unconsciously can be tempted to sell ourselves on Facebook. You know this because we all search for that one and probably lucky photograph image of us where we looked just so splendid and glowing and healthy and vital and surrounded by people who adore us. And that's what we present. And we will very often present ourselves in a light that is not really depicting any of our true lived experience. It can create a division between our internet self and our truly lived experience, which is actually psychologically unhealthy. Because if we believe that there's something wrong or missing or unembraceable about our truly lived felt experience, and we prefer the internet, that's creating a division or a compartmentalized life that is obviously unsustainable.
Could you...
Yes. Thanks. So, finally, missing the true experiences of life, we often cut short or feel compelled to hook up when we could actually check in and do something worthwhile by focusing our attention inwards. For example, if we come home from work and the first thing we want to do is check in with Facebook or emails, rather than take a moment to relax the body and become present again, what we're doing is actually burying our feelings. We're unattending to all the inner stress and the felt experience that's accumulated during the day. It's really important to give each experience in life its due before we cut away. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've seen people before lovely vistas taking photographs of themselves, and then amidst the moment of connection, amidst the moment of the sunset or the lovely park environment, uploading it and then looking at it on a little tiny little living when it's right there. I've seen people in museums take photographs of the paintings and then look at the painting on the smartphone. What are you doing? Anyway, some symptoms of what's known as, you can't make this shit up, internet use disorder known as IUD. losing track of time online. That's an effect of dopamine release that actually can become such an entrancing experience that we can lose track. Inability to control usage, saying, oh, I'm just going to be on for 15 minutes to somebody, and then a half hour later or an hour later suddenly realize we've lost track of what we had promised to do. Compulsion to connect. If there's a feeling of stress that arises when we cannot connect, then, unless obviously our life depends on connecting. Feeling guilty, defensive, or denying how much use we have are considered to be signs of addiction. Dependence on social networking for feelings of connection. Social networking is not really, truly deep, emotionally satisfying connection. Why is that? Good question. When we're truly connected with somebody, we employ neurons called mirror neurons, which are largely embedded in the somatosensory lobe of the brain. I see you and I can somewhat begin to feel what you're doing, and you vice versa. The connection is largely achieved via direct face-to-face experience, or at least it has to be a synchronous experience where we're in each other's environment. I cannot build any empathy with you, nor you with I, nor can I feel the experience of any sympathy or empathy if it's asynchronous, if you are not experiencing it with me. Do you get that? If it's a text or a posting that didn't happen, if I don't actually visually see you empathizing as I express my sadness, isolation, my anger, whatever, that will not be an emotionally rewarding connection. It may feel a little while like there's somebody out there, like the TV set does when we feel alone. And we turn on the TV set and there's little people. But actually, the felt, interactive, empathetic connection that happens between two people that triggers all of the parts of the brain that go into empathy and connection is not there. So we will feel hollow afterwards. We will not feel that sense that we've truly, deeply connected with someone. So let's talk about solutions. I'm just going to list about 8 or 9 that I put together for my own practice. This is by no means a complete list. It's just some that came to mind. And again, the Buddha taught a third way, which means using the external world as a tool to create or help develop the causes and conditions for happiness, but not depend upon it for happiness. That's the thing about conditional external life. If my happiness is conditioned entirely upon having an iced coffee in the morning, then I'm fucked whenever I'm in Europe, because those fuckers don't know how to make them. No, they're all wonderful people, but... All right, so, you get the idea. I was having a Lewis Black moment for those of you who know. All right. So, couple ground rules. Number one, always finish an experience before uploading it. If you're in an environment with someone, you take a picture, you think it's wonderful, that's great. Congratulations, the internet is full of them. It can wait until you get home later. Stay connected. Stay a part of. Feel what it's like to be outside. Feel what it's like to be with a friend. Stay a part of a situation where all the senses are engaged, not just the visual lobe looking at a screen trying to make sense of why Facebook is taking so long to upload the image. Stay connected. Let each experience in life unfold, not just in thought and visual, but as an entire felt experience. And then later on, when you set aside time in your life to connect, then upload it. But never interrupt an experience in life by disconnecting and connecting to the internet. Even if you're bored, boredom is not a bad thing. Boredom is invariably the mind saying that it's, or the mind letting us know that there's anxiousness or something that needs to be explored. And if every single time we're bored, we seek refuge in a smartphone, we're not learning how to unpack boredom and seeing what's beneath it. Always know what our underlying intention is before we turn to a laptop or social media. Always. This is important. Even if we're just honest with ourselves and say, I got 20 minutes to kill, fuck it. I'm just going to see what's going on. That's fine. The more you're aware of that, the more you will know just how much of our lives we're filling up with it, and how many uses and how much of our stress and suffering and discomfort is being filled by it. So just ask ourselves, why am I going to this? Why am I hooking up right now? What's the goal? What's the intention? If we ask ourselves this, and most of the time we don't know, or B, we're not too happy acknowledging, well, I'm feeling isolated. I don't feel like I have a lot of friends, so I'm going to go on to Facebook. That's a sign that there's something we need to investigate. How do we investigate it? We feel the loneliness, the isolation, then we pick up the phone and we actually call someone. On the other hand, if we simply seek the refuge, the false refuge of the internet, we're not addressing anything. We're not helping ourselves in any way. Always follow the rules of right speech when we engage in the internet. It may be tempting when people flame you and call you a fascist or a Marxist or whatever they call you. Happens all the time. It may be tempting, but we will live in the stress and the suffering if we get pulled into wrong speech. It will haunt our emotional landscape. If we want to stay clean, we have to follow the rules of right speech, which means asking ourselves, is this true? Do I know this is true? And does this have to be said by me? Does it have to be said now? we can also ask ourselves, is this needlessly divisive? Or is this just idle chatter, which means just putting something up, posting something, because we haven't posted anything today? Be authentic. If we're going to present ourselves to the world, present ourselves as we really look and we really feel. Don't only put up the images of ourselves at parties surrounded by people if there's times that we feel alone or isolated. If you're going to depict yourself, depict what's really occurring in life so there's not a division or a compartmentalization between the two. Here's an important one. I actually have a post-it on my computer for this one. Because I'm working on this shit too, folks. Step away from the screen before hitting the send button. This is very important. Before you push post or send, step away from the machine. If there's any doubt at all, if there's any feeling of tension in the stomach, locking of the jaw, or the shoulders are locked, anything that might even hint that there might be an element of unskillfulness, step away, breathe, relax the body and the breath, take a break from it, and after that spiritual pause, return and then re-look it over. I almost invariably, there's still any sense, I will then send the email to a third party and say, hey, what do you think? And more than a few times in my life, I've been saved by people saying, yeah, I see what you're saying, but that's a little harsh in this paragraph. We all do it. We all fall into it. When we feel attacked or abandoned, rejected, misunderstood, there's a temptation to react. And simply sending something to a third party and asking is very useful. Never avoid face-to-face interactions when we could do them. Never use, in other words, texting or the posting to achieve an important conversation that could be done either in person or at the very least on a phone. Asynchronous communication doesn't build up courage, experience, empathy, anything. It's simply an avoidance strategy. Obviously, there's one case where this doesn't work out. If there's a case where somebody is abusive in any way, then it's okay. If you're in a relationship that's abusive, where the person is verbally, physically abusive, and it's not safe, then, of course, that doesn't apply. But in any other situations where it's practical, please use direct communication. Observe the compulsion to connect via the internet, which means before we connect, go online, feel what's going on in the body and note the breath, the body, the feeling tones that are happening that are creating the impulse to connect. And then see if we can, before we connect, relax, breathe, soften. If we learn to do this before we go online and ask ourselves what our intentions are, the chances of us having a fruitful session online will be far greater. Finally, there are many, many products available that you can, if you want, buy, or timers and things like that, which will every hour ring and let you know to take a break. I think that anything that establishes a time for mindfulness, a time to pull away from being sucked into the screen and reconnect with the body and the other senses are going on, is healthy. So bear those in mind. So in other words, all of this boils down to we're not rejecting the internet, we're trying to use it in a skillful way. And the way we do this is by not using it as a tool for avoidance or a tool to answer underlying conditions that should be addressed outside like loneliness, frustration, disappointment, all of which can be much more fruitfully addressed online. Use it for the way it's intended. Be aware of the underlying physical impulsions, and I'm sure all of us can establish a very, very skillful interaction with it. I thank you for listening. Hope there was something there. And that